This is The State of Things. I'm Frank Stasio. This year marks the 60th anniversary of the landmark Supreme Court case, Brown versus the Board of Education, which, of course, ushered in an era of desegregation. But a new report by the Civil Rights Project at UCLA documents a trend toward resegregation here in North Carolina schools and elsewhere. Students across the state now attend schools that are increasingly isolated by race and socioeconomic class. And the report shows the damaging effects of segregation on students' education and social experiences. Joining us to talk about the report is Jen Askew. She's a research associate at the Civil Rights Project who co-authored the report. Welcome, Jen.
Thanks, Frank. It's good to be here.
It's good to have you with us. Civil Rights Project is looking at school segregation along the East Coast. Tell us what you found in North Carolina.
Well, we really have three main findings. First, we found that North Carolina's public school enrollment is becoming increasingly multiracial, which has been driven by an increase in the Latino and Asian shares of enrollment and a decrease in the white and black shares of enrollment. So in 2010, the state's enrollment was still slightly majority white, with 53% white students, about a quarter black students, 13% Latino students, and 3% Asian students. However, in spite of this increasing diversity, our second key finding is that students are now attending schools where they're increasingly isolated by race. In 1989, only 3% of North Carolina's schools were intensely segregated. And those are schools that have an enrollment that's 90 to 100% minority. And over the last two decades, the share of schools tripled so that by 2010, 10% of the state's schools were intensely segregated. And this is really concerning because of the increase and the trend toward more segregated schools.
I'm guessing that 3% mark that you noted in 1989 represented a decline over the decades. So if we were looking at a graph, we would see a decline in segregation and then a rise from 89 on. Would that be right?
Yes, you're exactly right. The peak of desegregation nationwide was during the 1980s. So since that time, we're seeing a trend towards more segregated schools.
Are there some districts that where this trend is more acute than others?
Yes. We looked in our report at the three major metropolitan areas in North Carolina, Charlotte, Raleigh, and Greensboro. And within those, we identified two districts where schools are more segregated than in others. In metropolitan Charlotte, Charlotte-Mecklenburg schools is more segregated than the rest of the state on average. So in 2010, 36% of Charlotte-Mecklenburg schools were intensely segregated. And that meant that two-thirds of Latino students and almost half of black students in Charlotte-Mecklenburg were attending those intensely segregated schools.
I'm joined by Mark Dorison at this point. He's the managing attorney at the UNC Center for Civil Rights, which is an organization that's been looking into the impact of school segregation around the state. Mark, welcome back. Good to have you here.
Thank you. It's great to be here.
So you hear this, Charlotte-Mecklenburg, the worst in this report. Here is the source and the site of a landmark legal case about desegregation being one of the worst resegregated schools in the district in the state. What's going on?
Well, in Charlotte, and we see this in other districts that were once under court order, that as soon as they are released from court order and no longer are compelled to continue to prioritize racial diversity, they quickly revert to a neighborhood schools plan or some kind of parental choice model and allow the schools to resegregate. What is compelling is the reality that the policies that are made at the local level to either prioritize diversity or integration or to retreat from it really define and shape what the schools look like.
Now, some of those schools, school boards, had created policies that called for more racial diversity and socioeconomic diversity. What happened to those programs?
Well, in Wake County, for example, where there was one of the most innovative student assignment plans was based on socioeconomic diversity, was tremendously successful for nearly 10 years. In 2009, there was a reaction, and conservatives took over the school board specifically to undermine that plan and return to what they called a neighborhood schools plan. And as your previous guest described, the neighborhood schools sound like a great idea in the abstract, but what we know is that we are still plagued by racially and socioeconomically segregated neighborhoods. So what was clear and what is clear is that the impacts of, say, a neighborhood schools plan can be predicted, foreseeable, on what the schools will look like racially and socioeconomically. And so what is so challenging is that school districts that adopt these policies know that they're creating these racially isolated, high-poverty schools.
Yeah, and we talked about Wake County's innovative and very successful program. It was based on socioeconomic background, not race. And that was because the courts had actually ruled against other programs that did use race as a marker, suggesting that that was a form of racism as well.
That's right. Wake County was innovative and very thoughtful. They saw actually what was happening in Charlotte, the reaction by white parents to the continuing use of race as a student assignment factor, and actually changed from a race-based assignment model to this SES model, socioeconomic status, and became a model that was replicated in nearly 100 districts across the country.
Jen, I ask you, tell us about the consequences of racial segregation on students and on education.
Well, research shows that segregated schools are strongly related to many forms of unequal educational opportunity and outcomes. And schools that are racially segregated also tend to be schools of concentrated poverty. So we're really talking about both racially and socioeconomically segregated schools. These schools have fewer experienced and less qualified teachers. They have high levels of teacher turnover and also less stable student enrollments. They tend to have inadequate facilities and learning materials, and then they also have higher dropout rates. So on the other hand, though, we know that desegregated schools are linked to a number of benefits for all students, including improved academic achievement from minority students and no negative corresponding impact for white students. They're also linked to improved critical thinking skills, a reduction in students' willingness to accept stereotypes, and a heightened ability to communicate and make friends across racial lines. And then they have a long-term effect, so that students who attend desegregated schools are more likely to live and work in diverse environments later in life. Although the desegregated schools don't create complete equality, they certainly make a significant difference and benefit both the students and communities that have more integrated schools.
Mark, we talked about the fact that Wake County had one of the most progressive diversity plans in the state and in the country, in fact. It was recognized nationally. And actually, the state of North Carolina had been fairly progressive in desegregating and was in the vanguard after the Brown decision, right?
It was. And following the Brown decision, there was an initial period of resistance, as there was in most southern states. But following the passage of the Civil Rights Act and then the landmark litigation that was brought in Charlotte that led to the authorization of the use of busing as a tool for desegregation really put North Carolina in the spotlight and in the forefront of desegregation. That combined with the very aggressive litigation of Julius Chambers and his colleagues made that issue the leading civil rights issue in North Carolina.
Is this just a matter of backlash, or are there other reasons that we're seeing this this return to segregation?
I think it is a backlash. I think there is a pattern going back really to the early 80s, where there has been a retreat from integration and diversity from the courts. There's been a clear agenda for the conservative movement. And I think one of the things that Jen just mentioned has really been lost in this. The opponents of diversity have really created this false dichotomy that you could either have diverse schools or you could have high-quality schools, and suggesting that those are incompatible or you can only have one or the other. All of the research, not just what the Civil Rights Project has done, but for years has shown that there are clear educational impacts, adverse educational impacts to these racially isolated and high poverty schools. And so the idea that you can talk about, and in North Carolina, we've been having a long conversation about a sound basic education that comes out of the longstanding Leandra litigation. The idea that you can provide a sound basic education in these segregated settings just gives lie to that dichotomy.
And of course, the advocates for local schools and local control and the argument that said these diversity programs have an adverse effect on us as families will tell you that they're not opposed to diversity. But I guess as we saw in the redlining discussion, these are intentional policies. You can't say that these policies didn't derive from an intention to be apart from African American or communities of color.
That's exactly right. These are the results of intentional policies. Whether you can – there's an argument to be made that the current student assignment policies, for example, are intended to segregate students. Aside, the fact is that they have that impact and they have that effect. And we know that effect hurts students, hurts all students. I have a colleague who talks about this, analogizes it to a product liability. You know, if there's a car that has a problem, you know, that causes people to be injured, we don't ask, well, why are they getting injured? Did they just do it to save money? Was it put together poorly? What we say is the car injures people, the product hurts people, so fix it. What we know is that racial segregation, socioeconomic isolation hurts students. And so we ought to be adopting policies that can fix it.
We're hearing about research that shows disturbing evidence. North Carolina schools are becoming resegregated, and this is the state of things. My guests are Jen Askew of the Civil Rights Project at UCLA and Mark Dorison, managing attorney at the UNC Center for Civil Rights. Jen Askew, you did this research elsewhere as well. Are you seeing the same results in other states?
We are. We're finding that across the nation, schools are becoming more segregated. And in comparison to the rest of the nation, North Carolina as a whole is less segregated on average. But because, as Mark described, North Carolina was such a leader in desegregation, this is particularly concerning because we had made such progress on desegregation in the past.
Mark Dorison, you've talked about the impact of charter schools and the expansion of charter schools as well. Do you think that has an impact on this?
Absolutely. There's recent research from Duke that shows that students in charter schools are more than twice as likely to be in a hyper-segregated school setting than students in traditional public schools. And there are no public policy constraints on the charter schools now. In fact, our state is falling all over itself to have more of them. There's also the clear impact that charters have on the schools from which they draw students. So if you pull a large percentage of African-American students out of a school district, that school district is going to also become less diverse.
Jen, what are some of the recommendations that you're making in your report?
We have a number of recommendations, but several that I could just highlight right now. First, it's important that school districts develop student assignment policies that consider race among other factors. And they can do that in a number of ways that are still permissible within the constraints of Supreme Court decisions. So they can use race as one of many factors, or they can consider the racial composition of a student's neighborhood in an effort to create diverse schools. Second, as you all were just discussing choice options, particularly charter schools are growing tremendously in North Carolina. So it's important that they promote more racially integrated schools. They can do that by including explicit diversity goals. They can provide information and outreach to families and diverse communities, provide free transportation for students, and provide services for all students, including English learners, students with disabilities, and free and reduced lunch eligible students. And then finally, school segregation and residential segregation are interrelated processes. So when we're talking about school segregation, it's also important to target housing policies and ensure that decisions made in the housing market are not exacerbating school segregation.
Mark, when you talk about charter schools, let's stick with those for a moment. There is a groundswell within some African American communities to promote charter schools because they, in many cases, feel underserved by school districts that are poor for the red line, for all the reasons that we talked about earlier in the program, but we'd like some choice. We'd like – so what you're saying and what I hear Jen saying is that it's the rules around charter school that would make the difference, not providing the choice, but providing a choice with public policy intention to promote diversity.
That's exactly right, Frank. Currently, charter schools aren't required to provide transportation. They aren't required to provide free or reduced lunch. And so while charter proponents will tell you we accept students on a lottery basis, we know that the people who are selected to be in that pool, who are choosing to be in that pool, is not a random sample of people attending our public schools. And so, again, I think the UCLA report makes very clear that demanding that diversity be a policy imperative is really critical.
What about housing? Is there anything we can do at the policy level to make housing more fair and diverse?
Fair housing laws are some of the last ones left for civil rights advocates, and they should be strongly and consistently enforced. I think that highlighting the connection, which, as you did in this program, between housing segregation, racial exclusion by residents, and school segregation is a critical component.
Well, thank both of you for being on the program today. Mark Dorison's managing attorney at the UNC Center for Civil Rights. Thanks, Mark.
You're welcome.
Jen Askew is a research associate at the Civil Rights Project who co-authored a new report that looks at segregation up and down the East Coast, including North Carolina. Thank you, Jen.
Thanks, Frank.
And thank you for listening to The State of Things. We've got a lot of information and links to all of that which we have spoken about. You can take a look at the interactive map on redlining at our website, stateofthings.org. Our program is produced by Laura Lee, Megan Modafferi, Anita Rao, and Will Michaels. Intern Charlie Shelton. Robin Copley is our technical director. Brent Wolf, the news director. North Carolina Public Radio is a broadcast service of the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill. I'm Frank Stachow.